You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to a new episode of Delirious Nomads, brought to you by Blacklight Media Records, a weekly podcast hosted by yours truly, celebrity chef Chris Santos. I hate calling myself that. And underground metal connoisseur Matt Bacon, who loves being called that. This is your new favorite podcast for all things heavy metal, as well as breakdowns of your favorite combat sports and riffing on some food talk every week with very special guests from across the globe.
Hello and welcome to the Delirious Nomads podcast, the Blacklight Media podcast where we try to highlight a whole bunch of the music industry. I am here today, Matt Bacon, without my usual co-host Chris Santos, but talking to a very dear friend of mine, the one and only Scotty Tank Crimes. How are you, Scotty Tank Crimes?
Hey, Matty B, what's up, bud? Nice to be here. I'm also a great chef, by the way.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm a house husband, so I cook dinner for the wife every night, and I've got some skills.
That doesn't surprise me. You know, yeah.
So for the Santos fans that are like hitting for the skip button right now on their podcast app,
we have another great chef for you here.
Vegan food only, by the way.
There you go. Okay. Scotty Tank Crimes runs, as one might have guessed, Tank Crimes, one of the sort of premier power violence and hardcore labels out on the West Coast. And it's been going for how many years now? 20, 25?
Last year was our 20th.
There you go.
Over 20. 21, you know, isn't exciting. Over 20 sounds like I'm old as fuck.
There you go. Over 20 years. Been a huge inspiration in my life. You know, Tank Crimes was a huge door opener for me. Specifically, the Municipal Waste Toxic Holocaust split from 2012. But on this note, Scotty, before we get into all of that, what were you like as a kid? You know, you have this really cool, nerdy, weird label. But what were you like growing up that kind of led to this?
Okay, I like this, Maddie. You told me you were going to give me a good, smart question to start us off, and I'm happy. Thank you. What was I like during a kid? You know, something that people probably wouldn't guess about me is I was really nervous all the time as a kid, and I would barf all the time. I was barfing all the time from like pre-puberty until into my like early 20s, just barfing from nerves all the time. When I went on tour with my first band, the gals thought I had Crohn's disease because they couldn't understand why I barfed every morning. And I was like, nah, I've done this my whole life. So nervous is how I always was. I don't know why. I've never nailed that down. And I don't know why it went away. But always into music, my first like love of music was hip hop. Hip hop was actually like my first punk. It was the first music that I like actively collected and researched and bought the publications and watched the videos and stuff like that. It was my first like super fandom music scratch. And that was like when I was like 10 years old, I would stay up and record the hip hop radio show in Detroit, which I was lived in a suburb, and listen to it just nonstop. And I knew, there's tons of hip hop songs that I still listen to today that like when I was like 11 years old, I could sing every word, but I didn't know who it was by. Like if it was a group or something or somebody who didn't name themselves a lot in their music, like I wouldn't even know. And so then it was fun like years later being like, oh, shit, that's this, you know. So that's what it was like growing up. And then I was also a really bad kid. And so I was sent to work early. Bad kid, pretty basic bad kid stuff around me, smoking cigs, stealing booze, sneaking out of the house. Got arrested when I was 12 for stealing my mom's car. That sent me to go live with my dad. And always stayed into music. But when I moved to my dad's, there weren't as many hip-hop hadn't made it that deep. I'd moved from a suburb of Detroit out to more rural Michigan. And hip-hop had not made it. I actually took a lot of, bully-type bullshit. I got a lot of bully-type bullshit for being into hip-hop. When I got out to my dad's house, I was about 13 at that point. So that actually got me into other music, because as much as I loved hip hop, I was a 13-year-old kid who just wanted to fucking fit in like anyone else, or at least not be in total hell at school. You know, that's when I just launched back into rock. My dad played in bands and stuff. My dad was actually on Bob Seger's label when he was in high school.
That's weird.
I come from like a rock based family, but my dad didn't keep playing in bands. Like, he like hung up his bass to go to college and kind of left that behind him. But he's always been a massive, and still is a massive, music fan. So then I started getting more into rock. I think, you know, I think I realized the other day, because maybe there was some anniversary, or maybe I was just talking about old music stores in the mall. But like, I had forgotten Tribe Called Quest's Low End Theory and Nirvana Nevermind came out on the same day. And when I realized that, that really just struck me right in my adolescence. I think I shoplifted both of those tapes, like at the same trip to the mall, right? The other thing musically and adolescently that not everybody that just follows Tank Crimes know, but all my friends knows, is I'm a huge hippie. You know, I smoke pot all the time. I've taken way too much acid over the, well, in my 20s and teens, too much acid and partying and stuff like that. But I love Fish and the Grateful Dead. And I got to see Grateful Dead play with Jerry a few times when I was in high school. I've done little weekend, I've never followed Fish or the Dead, but I've definitely done little weekend jaunts and stuff like that. And I still listen to that. I haven't seen Fish in over 15 years, even though I know they're still touring all the time. But I still listen to those albums a lot and take me back and really like it. And then, you know, right about the middle of my high school, you know, what happens after Nirvana? Green Day does, you know? And Rancid was actually like my first punk band, you know? Like, and it wasn't like I wasn't oblivious to the scene. Like I said, my dad was a rocker. Like, we had Ramones records in the house growing up, but I didn't know that was punk. You know, like, I didn't know that how much different my dad's Ramones record was from my dad's Montrose record, right? It was just guitar-based music from my dad's collection.
Sure. I had a similar experience.
You know, like you just don't know genres as much. I mean, I knew the difference between, I knew that Prince had some more dance music and some rock music, like going through my dad's collection and stuff. But like, you know, so I definitely like grew up with the Ramones and didn't realize so much it was punk. And so, but what happens is my dad owned a bar and grill in the town where I went to high school. And because I was a little bad kid, always in trouble, he just did what he had to do and put me to work. So I was washing dishes there at 12. The great irony that I get to laugh about with my dad now is that that's where I could get cigs and pot and booze and listen to fucking music. And, you know, like, now I'm working in the kitchen at a bar and grill. You know,
sure.
And so, you know, there's like other burnouts from, I'm in like ninth grade. There's burnouts who are like seniors. There's the dudes that are out of, you know, like my manager was like 21 or something, you know, like it was a very cool place to grow up, actually, was working at my dad's bar. And I kind of had two sets of friends, because not everybody who worked at my dad's bar or hung out there. And then there was like affiliated friends, you know, that I'd hung out through that, all didn't go to my high school or weren't in my same class or stuff like that. You know, even though we were in a small town, I kind of was living with two different sets of friends almost. I mean, it wasn't like they were totally apart from each other. And I, as a grown ass man, I still have, you know, a key handful of good friends from when I was young. A couple of people I'm still in touch with come from different sides of that split in my high school years, you know?
I understand. I had a similar experience, right? Where I was like going to black metal shows, but also sort of, also a high schooler. And so I like, but we would all sort of go to bars in the same neighborhood. And sometimes my high school friends would like bump into my black metal friends and be like, what the fuck are you doing?
Right. You know, since you said that, I think maybe there was a little more culture clash than I remember at the time, or maybe I anticipated it more or just tried to navigate that. You know, like I said, I was nervous all the time, even though at my dad's restaurant. And then here's the other thing, like my dad, you know, ran the restaurant as like an executive. He was certainly not in back in the kitchen on a Tuesday night after school when I'm working the fryers or, you know, stuff like that. And what that also allowed me to do was kind of get a late curfew throughout high school, because there'd be school nights where I had to like close, right? So my dad would go to bed.
Right.
And so I kind of, that was the other, like, the other space where like this, they're, you know, like the process of like tightening down on me was really loosening up this whole area and stuff. But I'd say in the kitchen of my dad's bar and grill, the Brighton Bar and Grill, Brighton, Michigan, is where I got into punk. We were always listening to tapes. Everybody would bring in their tapes. People would have, you know, their whole back seats of their cars would be full of tapes. You know, we even had, we didn't have lockers or anything, but I mean, everyone would just keep their stuff there. But like the number one personal possession that any back of house staff was bringing into work was fucking cigarettes and fucking tapes. And then we would, you know, argue who was better, Minor Threat or Rage Against the Machine, you know, or like the guy that would, I had a coworker who broke the Nirvana MTV Unplugged tape when somebody dared bring it in. Like shit like that would happen, you know, like it was just a fun, like rowdy environment. Everyone's taking cig breaks nonstop whenever you can. And it was a busy place too. So like, we're like working our asses off, but that's where I got into punk. And that's what kind of like when I was making like young adult decisions, you know, I moved out, I graduated high school young and moved out of my dad's house when I was still 17. But when I was making those like post high school decisions, I kind of went where with a, to where a lifestyle would be more music based than just like, I don't like smoking pot based or something. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. Did you get a sense that like you, that was going to maybe be something that would be better for you overall?
No, it just seemed like more fun. And I definitely wanted an adventure. And I definitely felt like I was too big for my small town. I went to a year of college, but I flunked out at Western Michigan University after high school. This is in Kalamazoo, about 4 hours from my dad's house. And there was, that was because there was this program in Michigan when I was young. I don't know if they still do this, but you could like buy for like a lump sum, you could buy a year of college, right? At a state school. And so like, that was the one I got into or whatever and went there. And then I totally like was never a good student, didn't like school at all. It was just like my immediate ticket out. What's funny is I got to tell my grandpa this before he died, but it was like the lamest fucking Christmas present in the world to get as a 10-year-old, right? But I fucking spent the shit out of it when I was 17, you know, because it was like an easy way just out of my folks' house right away. And that really empowered me that year to move to California.
Great.
And that was definitely a year of more like exploring. Like that's where I went to my first like DIY show.
Right, because you didn't really have that where you were.
No, I was from a small town, you know. And there's the thing there, like, there was kids, like, I obviously wasn't a jock in high school. The 90s were weird. Like, I can't really pigeonhole, like, what things were. But to me, there was, like, kids, like, more, like, punky alternative kids that were actually kind of cooler than me. Maybe in the not in the social order of the school, but like I had classes with kids who like played in bands and like went to Ann Arbor on the weekends to coffee shops and stuff like that. And I was getting into music or not, I was way too like chasing girls in a buzz to motivate to try to go to Ann Arbor on the weekends to do something even bigger and cooler, right?
Right, yeah.
I actually, I went to high school. Some people listening might know specifically who I'm talking about is I went to high school with Aaron Dillaway, who was in Wolf Eyes and is one of the like top five noise and electronics and just fucking crazy music guys. And, you know, and he's still at it and we're still in touch. He still does this Hanson Records and he might be on like release like fucking 1000, but I have Hanson Records number one. Like he put out a 7-inch while we were in high school. And that was just like I said, I was like, there was a joint and a teenage girl in between me and ever trying to do something that just was so impressive to me, but just seemed like so foreign. I'm like, what? You put out a record? Like, what the fuck? That's insane. And I never felt empowered to do that for, I don't know, 6 more years after I actually had met someone who'd done it, you know?
Which is also cool because, and obviously the 90s were weird, but like that was still a rare thing to know, right? Like it was rare to like know someone who had put out a record.
Yeah, like I didn't even know how to wrap my head around it. Even like the music that came from DIY that I was listening to, like I didn't know how to differentiate everything. It took me a few years to like digest it more. I didn't know that like the Minor Threat cassette came from a whole different world than a Slayer cassette. Like, right. I didn't know that. You could just shoplift them both from the same store at the mall, you know? So I don't know, you know, like my Black Flag tape and any hip hop tape, that was just all the same. I didn't think that some were coming. I mean, I was already had already moved out of my town before I met anyone who was straight edge. And I knew the Minor Threat song and I didn't think that was like a real thing. Like I thought Minor Threat did that or whatever, but I didn't know it had spawned a massive subculture.
Yeah.
You like know,
Like
I even remember now, like one of the girls in my high school that like went out and did shit on the weekends. I remember she had a Gorilla Biscuits long sleeve it's probably worth $1 million today if she still has it. And she wore it like all the time. And I never knew what the fuck it was. I think I even remember the first time being like, oh, like seeing a Gorilla Biscuits album and being like, oh, that's a band. And then learning about like straight edge and hardcore and stuff and being like, dang, like that girl was in my English class the whole time. And I never knew. She might've been the first like real participating hardcore kid I ever met in my life. And we never spoke about hardcore. And then it turns into my life, or at least I'm a hardcore affiliate. You know, I'm affiliated to hardcore.
Yeah. And that's like sort of what I think makes the scene in general so interesting, right? Because I have like, it's sort of funny the way you tell this story, because with one of my best friends, Matthias, who I went to high school with, and I was like the first person he met who was into Amon-Ra or like post-metal and stuff. And now that's like a lot of his favorite stuff. And I think he just didn't. Yeah, I see that other side of it. Yeah. Where like you have someone sort of expose you to it, but you don't really wrap your head around it until later on. Then you're like, oh, this is what I needed.
Yes. And so all that then leads me to moving to California.
Yeah.
But I didn't move to San Francisco at first. I moved to Lake Tahoe. I thought I wanted to come out west for beauty. Michigan's very flat. There's a lot of lakes. There's a lot of beauty to Michigan. But like, I I wanted Lake Tahoe. I just, Lake Tahoe was like, it's in California and it looks like that, all that shit, you know?
Sure.
And I get there and I'm 18 or 19 years old and South Lake Tahoe is fucking smaller than the town I went to high school in. Like, I didn't know, right? Like, you got on the Nevada side, there's casinos and stuff, but it's a small ass fucking town. And so I get there and we're not 21. We're still kids. So we just end up having like a party house where like high schoolers are coming over, but like, we're all the same age, right? Like, we're just like a year out of high school and have a place. So, and I just like, right, I was like, wait, like this is not what I was trying to do, you know? And like, my friends were like way getting into like mountain life and living. Like, some of the people I lived in Tahoe with like are still like dedicated mountain men in Colorado and stuff like that now. And I just, that wasn't my lifestyle at all. And I just really didn't know it. Like, it was so crazy, like realizing like the town was so small. And I fucking caught a ride to San Francisco one weekend and I just didn't go back to Tahoe for like 3 weeks. I just stayed and I just was like, like, this is what's up. Like, this is what I want. Then that's how I ended up in San Francisco. Like, just, I came down to check it out for a weekend and was like, yeah, this is it. Go ahead. Nah, I don't need a ride home. Like, I'm going to figure it out.
What made San Francisco click for you?
It was just a city. I'd never lived in a city. I didn't know that's what I was looking for. Right. Like I said, I was chasing beauty. Like, I knew I wanted to go west. Right. And so I end up in Lake Tahoe and it was cool. Like, we had some bands play at our house and stuff. You know, it was cool to like meet. See, I didn't realize too that all California kids like jocks at their high school listen to fucking Pennywise and Operation Ivy and shit. Like, I was not ready for that at all. Right. For like a lot of like all the Epitaph punk that was still pretty, even though there was Warped Tours and stuff going on then. And this is 97 or so, I guess. I just didn't realize how different it was to listen to like Epitaph bands if you're from California.
Right.
Right. Then if you're from fucking rural ass Michigan, we're like, this is the most underground shit in the world. Even though, you know, five of the bands are on the fucking radio, it still felt underground, you know? So that was like a thing. And I just wanted to do something bigger. And again, I didn't move to San Francisco. Oh, so what you're saying, what brought me there? It was kind of like beauty. Like, let me try, like, this city's so beautiful. Let me try this. There was just really like coming from just flat ass farm ass small town Michigan. Like, I was looking to scratch an itch. And like, as soon as I fucking, you know, as soon as like my fucking, I turned on my Walkman and my skateboard hit the ground, like, I was all in on San Francisco. I got a fucking paper map and would just fucking hop on a bus and hop off somewhere random and fucking look on the map where the fuck I was and skate around. And it was dope, but I still wasn't involved in punk. But that's what there was a, now I'm somewhere where there's a live music scene. Right.
Right.
So I'm going out to everything, hip hop shows, reggae shows, punk shows, metal shows, fucking any fucking kind of show. Weird. This is like early Burning Man parties and shit. Like, I went to Burning Man parties like before they even started going to the desert and shit like that, you know, like just crazy, freaky shit. We're like doing acid all the fucking time. Like, you could like just like walk down the street. And this is funny, Maddie, because you missed out on, like, I don't think this happens anymore. I think you're just too young, but they called it a puddle. You could just put out your hand and someone would just squirt liquid acid into it, like fill your whole fucking hand. And then you're just like, oh, thanks. Whoop. See you tomorrow.
Wait, elaborate. So are you paying someone for this service or is it just happening?
Both, right? So like either you and your friends got a vial of liquid acid or you're seeing a stranger on the street who either wants to give you some for profit, or when you're tripping on acid all the time, it feels kind of good to just pass along the trip, right, to someone else. Or like they still had mescaline back then. So like two micro dots on Hate Street were like viewed, were like $2 for $4 or something like that. Like this is like free ass drugs, dude. Like drugs that get you fucked up for a whole day that were like basically free. Right.
Right.
And I'm just exploring everything. I got a job at fucking Ben and Jerry's right in the Castro, which is the gay neighborhood or the gayest neighborhood, definitely in San Francisco, top 3-5 in America for sure. I didn't know any gay people that were out. I know now I had some friends who came out later, but I never knew one single gay person until I moved to San Francisco. And that was exciting to me too. That was definitely something I didn't grow up around or know anything about. So I was like, well, I'll get a job in that neighborhood. That was fucking insane. Doing acid at work, dance parties coming in all the time, like working with other just, you know, cool ass freaks and shit. It was dope.
That's wild.
And then we discover, and I've got like a group of friends and it was a cool little hodgepodge of friends into hip hop and punk and skateboarding. And, you know, so I like lived with like DJs and then people that I did bands with and stuff like that. Like we were really an eclectic bunch. And honestly, for worse, like really, unfortunately, when I finally got into underground DIY punk, we discovered like there was a record store, Mission Records, pretty famous place for the underground or whatever. But that was the first place I ever went. Like I'm living in San Francisco for years. I'm still going to concerts, bro. Right. Like I'll go see Bouncing Souls with a Barricade, you know, or fucking a Raucous Records hip hop fucking showcase or Jurassic 5 or something. But these are like in bars and venues and stuff like that. Right. All of a sudden, I'm like, wait, these bands just set up in the back of this record store and you can bring your own beer in here. And like, there's no stage and like, people don't even like necessarily know how to like play that. Like, you know, like I'd only been to concerts where people are so practiced and well rehearsed and stuff. Like I'd never just seen this, like, I don't know. It just blew me fucking away, man. And I was like, I want to do that. I want to be in a band. Let's start a fucking band. I played drums. I was the one who was chosen to play drums because I was making the most money at the time, which we were all poor, but I was the guy who could like save up $300 out of the four of us or whatever, you know?
Sure.
And then, yeah, I was just all in. And what I was saying at the beginning, what was unfortunate is it's like, I'm still friends with all the people I lived with in San Francisco. Cause shortly after we start doing all this punk stuff, I moved to Oakland too, because it was like punker. Right. But I was so focused on something for the first time in my life, just focused like a fucking laser that this is what I wanted to do. And I didn't know it meant that fucking 25 years later, I'd be telling this story on Maddie B's podcast, but I knew I was finally like excited and it was like something for me, right? Sure. Like I wasn't going to be an outsider here. I was going to be in it. And that's where it goes. And then now, you know where the story goes from here. I get the 1-inch button maker. I learn how to play rudimentary fucking drum beats and I fucking forge into the Bay Area hardcore, underground hardcore punk scene. Just aggressively wanting to meet everyone, wanting to do stuff. Once I had a band, I was the band dad right away. Let's book a show. Let's do that. Oh, then I learned, oh, you just book your own shows if you want a show. Oh, I guess I'm a promoter now. Boom. And then the friendly and not so friendly competition that comes along with stuff like that too. All just fucking kicked me right in my ass, dude, to do all the stuff.
Right. And now you're piece by piece that turns into the label.
Yeah, slowly but surely. You know, I mean, it took, the label starts in 2002, not by me, by this guy, Bob, who asked my band Deadfall to put out our 7-inch. And we're like, cool, what's your label? He's like, I got a new label, Controlled by Plague. You guys are going to be my first release. We're like, sick. But this is how cool punks are, man. He buys us 1,000 records, 7 inches, drops them off at our house, and is like, there's your records. I'm going to go train hopping all summer. And so how he put out the record was just paying for the record, and then he gave them all to us. But we thought we were on a record label, right? Like, we thought the record label was going to, like, get us a review in Maximum Rock and Roll and get us played on, like, some of the punk shows, like Equalize and Distort out of Toronto and stuff, like, just the kind of stuff that, like, a DIY hardcore label in the early 2000s, you know, did for a band. We'd have an ad in Maximum or an ad in Razor Cake or Heart Attack was still going, you know, like,
sure.
The label brings you into the culture more because now you have a product. Like, for better or worse, that's what's happening, you know?
Sure.
But that wasn't what happened. We just were given all the records, which is insanely generous.
So was he expecting you to, like, write him a check at the end of the summer?
No, not at all. It was, I want to put out your record. Here's your record. It's that simple. And we're still friends with Bob to this day. He's done it to a couple other bands. It's just his fucking style. By the way, this is also when 7 inches cost like $1 a piece to make. And certainly $1,000 or $15 or $2,000 was way more money than I had ever had at one time. But he did. You know, I don't remember how Bob had money. I feel like Bob had some cool ass fucking blue collar job that was like seasonal or something, because he'd always just like take off and travel for months at a time and then be back. But I can't even nail down, remember why Bob had, you know, $1,800 to spend on fucking Deadfall. So what happens next? I'm the band dad. I'm the guy. All right. Well, you know, I'm calling fucking Jeff at 6 Weeks Records, Max at 625, Felix Havoc, fucking all. Hey guys, like, these are like people I've met from the scene. You know, they're like the movers and shakers of my time, you know. Hey, what do I do? You know what? And those guys really, you know, Jeff from 6 Weeks and Felix Havoc were my earliest mentors in record label. And, you know, and I appreciate the hell out of them for that. I'm telling the story now, you know, but like, I remember Jeff like giving me a list. He was like, oh, here's places you can send. This is when I was way more review outlets too. You know, he's like, here's a bunch of people you can send a record to for review. Here's some people that might want to trade with you. Oh, so then guess what now? Guess who's got a distro? Cause I got I'm trading records. So see how it builds. It's like, so I'm like liking it. And now I've got a distro. And right. This record that's mine, I didn't put it out, but it's mine. And now I've been the face of the record with the zines, with the other labels I'm trading with everything. That's my label, right? And so so that's how it happened. So I still consider that my first release, but I did not pony up the money. And then for those first few years, like I said, like, we were so like, how do you save up $2,000? Like, that's just how am I ever going to have that kind of money? And we were just really just nickel and diamond everything, man. And then once I had my distro, I got my buttons. Now I'm like, I need more money. I'd start screen printing t-shirts. And I had this old lady cart and I would push that fucking thing. I mean, I started in San Francisco even before we moved to Oakland. We lived way out in the sunset in San Francisco. Now that's the beach side, right? Downtown's on the bay side. So San Francisco's not that big, but that's all the way across town just to hop the train that'll take you under the bay over to Oakland or Berkeley too, or in Richmond, which is where at this point a lot of the shows are happening. So I would fill that old lady cart, man, buttons rolled up on this big like mat, fucking 7 inches, tapes, handful of bootleg fucking shitty t-shirts, and I would just push that cart to the fucking Muni train, through the BART train, fucking to get to Gilman, like through all these trails, or to get to Burnt Ramen was in such a bad neighborhood, the safest way to get there was to actually stay on the tracks, like don't leave the station and walk the tracks, because people weren't on the tracks because they were fenced off, and then you could hop the fence when you got by the club. Because going through the station and out through Richmond could be super sketchy. You know, like we definitely, all the punks always knew, like, don't do that alone.
That's wild.
And there it was, you know, And so it happened, you know, within a couple years, I'm booking national tours. I'm touring with one or two bands every single summer. I'm hosting bands, not just in the Bay, but like on the whole West Coast, and just fucking loving it. And still not imagining that it would be my grown ass man's job now. And you would be asking me about it. Like, cause that still, like I said, like there was no money, man, no money. When we would go on tour, I would feel guilty because I could sell. We go to like Rochester, New York, and I've got fucking, you know, all these sick bootleg fucking 1-inch buttons and fucking patches and shit. That's what people want. I got the 7-inch distro. We could go into a town like that and I could make like $150 on buttons. The band gets paid $30 for the show.
Yeah.
So, right? But I built the distro with the records that were given to all of us, not me. I'm just the one who took it over. So we were actually, that's where the record really came in. I mean, a lot of it was my buttons. We were making way more money than with 7 inches out of the distro, but I would just pay the gas and stuff out of the fucking Tank Crimes distro money. You know, Karate Rex is what we called it then, Scotty Karate being my stage name. And that's what the distro was called, which was a nod to Havoc Rex, which he has since taken the REX off his name. He's back to Havoc Records, but also Mission Records, the spot that I told you was my first DIY shows, also did the REX, Mission Rex.
Yeah.
And so that was it. But at the time, I still kind of thought like one day I was going to have to get a job. And of course, now I'm like screen printing for friends. I'm doing other jobs. You know, how the Dystopia catalog ends up on Tank Crimes is that I go to work for Mao's at his print shop. And that was like my last real job. And I'm doing that, you know, because there was like just no money in the label, you know, at all. It just slowly starts to work. And then the other key thing that happens is my very first tour was with Municipal Waste in basements. And what happens in like 2006 at the end of the year is Municipal Waste's first Earache record comes out and they're fucking superstars, right? Like I booked their last like DIY tour down the West Coast and 4 out of 7 venues or something got shut down or shows got shut down by the cops. Cause we're still trying to play like the underground spot, right? But all of a sudden this band's big. And so that's actually then how I learned how to do like pro label stuff, right? Now I'm paying attention to what Earache's doing and what Guar is doing and what, you know, just like I'm looking at other people who are making it work in other ways and seeing how they're doing it and just kind of always, you know, like seeing what works, seeing what's like, especially with the metal labels, like still like what's not totally fucking corny to me because I'm a punk, like, and all that metal shit's fucking corny as hell. You know that because we work together. What's my number one thing? I'm always saying when we're working on ads and stuff, I'm like, Maddie, that's corny, man. I bet you have other accounts that would love this though. Reuse it. Not for me. And you know what you're doing.
And yet you let me go crazy on Google ads.
Yeah, you know, there's places where there's freedom. And then there's other places where I'd like have to not take myself so seriously, you know, sure. Which is all part of this too, you know, like take your art very seriously. Don't take yourself seriously at all. So there's sometimes where I'm like, specifically with this kind of stuff where I'm like, trust Maddie, this is his job. I'm coming to him for this, you know?
For sure. So point being, that's sort of, I want to kind of call it there and then have you back in the future. Cause I think that's a really good origin story of Tank Crimes, which is cool and deep. And I'm glad, and it spurned out of one question I asked you, which I love.
Yeah, no, and that was really cool. Thanks, Maddie, because that was much more than Tank Crimes. I mean, you took me way back, so that was fun.
The first 25 years.
The first 25 years, and I'm 45 now, so we're going to need a couple more chapters there, bud. Though it gets blurry after that. Once I start touring all the time, it just turns into a blur for like 10 years.
Tell me about it. Anyway, thank you. Everyone for listening. Thank you, Scotty, for coming.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, so that was awesome. Thank you everyone out there for listening to Delirious Nomads, sponsored by Blacklight Media. We will be coming back at you next week with another awesome guest. Be sure to follow Blacklight Media on socials for new music and more, and above all, keep it heavy.
It is now 2024, and the choice is up to you. Do you listen to good podcasts, or do you listen to bad ones? Well, we've got a suggestion for you. How about you listen to a good podcast for the first time in your miserable life? I can think of one. Overnight Drive. Going strong. 11 years now. The podcast about nothing. Your favorite podcast's favorite podcast. Do you enjoy nothing? So do we. Why don't you come over and check it out and stop listening to other podcasts? Thank you.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.